The use of this text or audio material is subject to the TR American Patriot User Agreement located at tramericanpatriot.com. CC Introduction. A compilation of the messages and papers of the presidents. By James D. Richardson. Volume 2nd. Prefatory Note. The first volume of this compilation was given to Congress and the public about May 1, 1896. I believe I am warranted in saying here that it met with much favor by all who examined it. The press of the country was unsparing in its praise. Congress, by a resolution passed on the 22nd day of May, ordered the printing of 15,000 additional copies of the entire publication. I have inserted in this volume a steel engraving of the Treasury Building. The succeeding volumes will contain engravings of other important public buildings. The resolution authorizing this work required the publication of the annual, special, and veto messages, inaugural addresses, and proclamations of the presidents. I have found, in addition to these documents, others which emanated from the chief magistrates, called executive orders. They are in the nature of proclamations, and have like force and effect. I have therefore included in this, and will include in the succeeding volumes, all such executive orders as may appear to have national importance or to possess more than ordinary interest. If this volume meets the same degree of favor as the first, I shall be greatly gratified. James D. Richardson. Elizabeth Cortright Monroe was the daughter of a retired captain in the British Army, who, after the peace of 1783, remained in New York. She married Mr. Monroe there during a session of Congress, but later the seat of government was removed to Philadelphia, where they resided until 1794, when Monroe was made envoy extraordinary and minister plenipotentiary to France. Her husband's several foreign positions of trust obliged them to live much abroad. She saved the life of Madame de Lafayette, who, upon the very day of Mrs. Monroe's call at the prison, was to have been beheaded, but was liberated by the powerful support of the American minister's wife. Mrs. Monroe was elegant, accomplished, dignified, and charming, and her drawing rooms were more ceremonious than those of Mrs. Madison. She died suddenly, 1 year before her husband, who spent the remainder of his life with his daughter Mrs. Governor in New York, the vanguard of Western expansion. The home builder did not strike out a path into the virgin forest and in a promising glade built his habitation. He came along in a process of evolution. Like foam on a wave, the vanguard of immigration was formed by pioneers, land jobbers and speculators. Listening into the promising parts of the Great West, they bought empires, without cash but on trust, as fast as surveyors could lay out townships. Then came a man whom they could induce to go no farther west but settle there, in the land they had for sale, which he might purchase with its timber or other produce. Completing the transaction, they again rushed westward, and so continued toward the setting sun till the ague, Indians or hardship had killed them. Our purchaser meanwhile has cleared an acre, sowed a handful of wheat and girdled a dozen trees, but gain does not seem sufficiently plentiful, and he won't know peace till he, too, is traveling westward. So after many exchanges, by each of which the clearing is improved, it falls into the hands of a man who determines that forevermore that glade in the forest, that bend in the stream, shall be home to him and his. Then the earth begins to bear fruit and so the wilderness is conquered. Nearly every presidential message contains recommendations for the welfare of the emigrant. Under the heading, Lands, Public, in the Encyclopedic Index, the story of the development of the West is told. Monroe. I have been requested to write my opinion as to by what act or policy will ex-President Monroe be best remembered by posterity. Public men are remembered not so much for what they are as for what great policies or acts their names happen to be associated with. The plain, simple-minded backwoodsman, Daniel Boone, occupies a large place in the history of this country, because he first pushed westward into the wilderness and established a home for our race beyond the Alleghenies, and learned lawyers and statesmen of that time who would have looked down with contempt upon the plain pioneer have been forgotten, while Boone is gratefully remembered by millions of Americans. James Monroe is peculiarly fortunate, because his name is associated, first, with the great westward extension of our domain beyond the Mississippi, and secondly, with the enunciation of a great doctrine which must for all time dominate the Western Hemisphere. When President Jefferson saw the necessity of securing the mouth of the Mississippi, in order to prevent the Western backwoodsmen from going down the river and forcibly taking possession and thus precipitating a war with France, Jefferson being of a conservative and somewhat timid nature, he attempted to divert this by purchasing from France the mouth of that river, and having confidence in the ability of Mr. Monroe, he sent him on a special mission to France for this purpose. As Napoleon was about to declare war against Great Britain, and knowing that the British fleet had weakened the sea power of both France and Spain, and that it would be almost impossible to hold the mouth of the Mississippi River, he was in a frame of mind to treat favorably the proposition made by Mr. Monroe, and our minister to France, Mr. Livingston. Through their combined efforts, but more particularly through the efforts of Mr. Monroe, we were enabled to secure for a small sum not only the mouth of the Mississippi, but the vast territory extending west to the Rocky Mountains, thus fixing the destiny of this country and making it for all time the dominant power in the Western Hemisphere. After the crushing defeat of the French and Spanish navies by Nelson at Trafalgar, Great Britain was left mistress of the seas, which supremacy, however, was disputed in 1812 by the descendants of the sea rovers who had commenced to build a great empire in the Western Hemisphere. The Spanish colonies extending from Mexico to Cape Horn had succeeded in throwing off the Spanish yoke, but European powers, fearing the extension of republican institutions, formed what is known as the Holy Alliance, with Russia at its head, and determined to aid Spain in reconquering her American possessions. At this juncture Mr. Canning, the British minister, proposed to the American minister at London that the two countries should stand together in resisting, if necessary, by force of arms, this interference by European powers in American affairs, and assured him that Great Britain would lend efficient aid to the United States, if necessary, in preventing this. This proposition was forwarded by President Monroe to Mr. Jefferson at Monticello, who replied that this was the most important subject brought to his notice since the Declaration of Independence, and advised the President to accept the proffered aid of England, and the celebrated Monroe Doctrine, which was promulgated by President Monroe in his message of December 2, 1823, was the result. This doctrine, which never had legislative sanction, has been accepted by the American people as a policy which must be enforced, if necessary, by a resort to arms, and has also been accepted by some of the foreign powers. This doctrine was re-enunciated when Napoleon III attempted to put a foreign king upon the throne of Mexico, and the United States placed an army upon the Mexican border and notified Napoleon that the French troops must be withdrawn and the Mexicans must decide for themselves what form of government they desired. It was again re-enunciated recently in the Venezuela question, and the interpretation put upon it by this government was accepted by England, the only great sea power having anything like an ability to dispute it. A doctrine like this, which is accepted by the entire population of a great country, irrespective of party, is more potent than any mere legislative action, and for the enunciation of this great doctrine Monroe must for all times be honored as one of the great Americans. The potency of this doctrine should be an inspiration to our rulers for future times, showing them that great ends may be achieved by the firm and fearless enunciation of great doctrines by the president of a great people independent of legislative action. It has a material bearing on the tremendous problem soon to be solved in the Far East. James Monroe. March 4, 1817 to March 4, 1825. James Monroe. James Monroe was born April 28, 1758, in Westmoreland County, Virginia. He was the son of Spence Monroe and Elizabeth Jones, both natives of Virginia. When in his 18th year he enlisted, as a private soldier in the army to fight for independence, was in several battles, and was wounded in the engagement at Trenton, was promoted to the rank of captain of infantry. During 1777 and 1778 he acted as aide to Lord Stirling, and distinguished himself. He studied law under the direction of Thomas Jefferson, then governor of Virginia, who in 1780 appointed him to visit the army in South Carolina in an important mission. In 1782 he was elected to the Virginia Assembly by the County of King George, and was by that body chosen a member of the Executive Council. The next year he was chosen a delegate to the Continental Congress, and remained a member until 1786. While a member he married a Miss Courtright, of New York City. Retiring from Congress, he began the practice of law at Fredericksburg, that point in, but was at once elected to the legislature. In 1788 was a delegate to the state convention assembled to consider the federal constitution. Was a senator from Virginia from 1790 to 1794. In May, 1794, was appointed by Washington minister to France. He was recalled in 1796 and was again elected to the legislature. In 1799 was elected governor of Virginia. In 1802 was appointed by President Jefferson envoy extraordinary to France, and in 1803 was sent to London as the successor of Rufus King. In 1805 performed a diplomatic mission to Spain in relation to the boundary of Louisiana, returning to London the following year, returned to the United States in 1808. In 1811 was again elected governor of his state, but in the same year resigned that office to become Secretary of State under President Madison. After the capture of Washington, in 1814, he was appointed to the War Department, which position he held until 1815, without relinquishing the office of Secretary of State. He remained at the head of the Department of State until the close of Mr. Madison's term. Was elected president in 1816, and re-elected in 1820, retiring March 4, 1825, to his residence in Loudoun County, Virginia. In 1829 was elected a member of the convention called to revise the constitution of the state, and was unanimously chosen to preside over its deliberations. He was forced by ill health to retire from office, and removed to New York to reside with his son-in-law, Mr. Samuel L. Governor. He died July 4, 1831, and was buried in New York City. But in 1858 his remains were removed to Richmond, Virginia.